The digital station for comedy, drama and entertainment. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now here's Michael Palin reading from the second volume of his diaries, The Python Years. The fun and mayhem continues as the Pythons head to the US to promote the Holy Grail. But at home, the team are making tentative moves away from Python with their own ventures.
Saturday, February the 22nd, 1975. I suppose this could be said to be the day on which Python finally died. Obviously, only time will tell whether this is a hopelessly overdramatic reaction, but at the time of writing, it does feel as though the group has breathed its last after nearly 6 years of increasingly doddery life. The conditions of its demise were quite unspectacular. Eric dropped round for tea. I really had no idea that he had any bad news or even news for me. We went upstairs to my workroom, where Eric told me that he couldn't go on with Python. The decision hadn't come lightly, but he felt that he had to get out, or he would, as he put it, go mad. He hadn't anything he was going to do, he just wanted to enjoy the experience of waking up in the morning, knowing I don't have to do anything. He has a novel, his Rutland Weekend television series, to add to a successful radio series, and he's understandably anxious to shed his old Python skin. Eric, the loner, is moving on, like John did. But he did say that if John came back to do a TV series, he'd come back too. But meantime, he just wanted to take it easy, write his new book and maybe work on a play. There was nothing I could say but bully for you. Now I feel blissfully liberated from a tiresome duty as one of the Python anchormen. Now perhaps I can be selfish as well. The prospect is interesting. Monday, February the 24th. Graham takes the news of Eric's latest decision stoically, to say the least. He smiles, as if he knew what was going to happen, and betrays no outward and visible signs of distress, anger or anxiety whatsoever, apart from taking a beer at 10:30. The two Terrys are equally resigned. The news from America daily lends an extra air of unreality to the situation, for, by all accounts, Python is catching on in the States as the prestige programme to watch, whilst back in little old quaint provincial London, it has finally run its course, and four of its creators are sitting around deciding who's going to do the cleaning up before the place is finally locked up for the year, or maybe forever. We lunch together, the four of us, united at this time like a family who've just lost a close relative. The two Terriers and myself feel liberated. Graham apologised for being late, but he was buying plasticine and knitting needles. A moment's incomprehension, then Graham explains that you make figures out of the plasticine and stick knitting needles in them. Thursday, February the 27th. A call from our agent, Jill Foster. She tells me the BBC is interested in a Michael Palin show. I couldn't quite believe it, but coming a week after Stephen Frears' offer of a part in a TV version of Three Men in a Boat, it makes me feel excited and confident and quite unsure of the future. Too much is happening. But after some reflection, I realise I do want my independence. Friday, March the 7th, New York. Due to an almost insatiable demand for us to help publicise the Python TV series and the opening of the Holy Grail, we fly to New York from a grey and drizzling London on a TWA jumbo. The city is as brash, as bold, as booming as ever. Once again I was amazed, impressed, excited by the size and grace of these huge, soaring steel and glass monsters pressing in around me. In a half hour on the street, all the cobwebs of the long, dull flight were blown away, and I experienced again the sheer delight of walking in New York. Sunday, March the 9th. We wandered down with our photographer towards the Plaza Hotel. He took a few shots of the four of us standing in front of the ponies and traps which do trips around Central Park. After only about 20 seconds of shots, one of the men sourly grunted about us losing him custom. There was no one for miles anyway, and moved his horse to the other side of the street. but what caused Graham and I to laugh all the way back to the plaza was when one of the horses took a sudden and very violent lunge at Terry Jones. The wonderfully aggrieved indignation in Terry's voice I remember forever.
He's bitten a lump out of my coat.
Sure enough, there was a chunk of fur missing from the sleeve of Terry's brand new big brown shaggy coat. Saturday, March the 15th, Dallas, Texas. Drove down to the public broadcasting station in Dallas to find ourselves facing a barrage of microphones and reporters. I've never seen anything like it. Admittedly, most of the microphones belonged to young, fresh-faced lads with cheap cassette recorders, and none of the mics had NBC, ABC or CBS News stuck on the end. But this was the first time any of us have ever experienced this saturation coverage. Questions fell fast, one on top of the other. It could have been awful, but it was so spontaneous, it was exhilarating. Sunday, March the 16th. We were driven round Dallas and shown the Kennedy Memorial, which it took 8 years for anyone in Dallas to put up. We're told that people in Dallas hated President Kennedy. After his assassination, classes of school kids cheered, and a teacher who tried to give her class a day off in Kennedy's memory was fired. We eventually found ourselves at the scene of the shooting. What struck me most was the eerie ordinariness of the spot. Here we were, on a cool March Sunday, standing on the most famous, well, the only famous, grassy knoll in the world, looking up at the book depository window from which Oswald had fired, and across to the road where Kennedy had been shot. The strongest impression is that Oswald must have been a genius to fire three times accurately from that angle, at a car travelling away from him down a sloping road. Second impression is that the grassy knoll, besides offering a much closer and easier view of the target, was an ideal place for any assassin to escape from. An expanse of open railway land, away from streets, cars and sightseers. Friday, April the 25th, New York. At 12 o'clock, we rolled up outside a modestly fashionable brownstone, the studio of Richard Avedon, by all accounts, one of the world's leading photographers, and he has chosen to photograph no less than us. Python is to be immortalised in the pages of Vogue. We're a bit dazed from our publicity efforts, and he must have found us a lifeless lot. But after 10 or 15 minutes of uninspired ideas, he leapt on the suggestion made by Graham and Terry Jones that we should be photographed in the nude. The idea sounded no worse and a lot better than putting on silly costumes or funny faces, so it was resolved. We would keep our shoes and socks on, though, and I would wear my hat. Soon the Python group were a little naked gaggle, and Avedon was busy arranging us in a parody of the sort of beautiful person photo where all is revealed, but nothing is shown. So our little tadgers had to be carefully hidden behind the knee of the man in front and so on. And every now and then Avedon would look through the viewfinder of his Rolleiflex and shout things like, "Balls! Balls, Graham! Balls!" After a few more exhortations like this, Graham was heard to mutter, "Are you sure he's the world-famous photographer?" We dressed, muttering jokily amongst ourselves about how ashamed, how very ashamed we were of what we'd done. The elf in Avedon talked to us as he scribbled some letter. I couldn't help noticing that it began, "Dear Princess Margaret." Sunday, April the 27th. We were to be at Cinema 2 on 3rd Avenue at 11 o'clock to welcome the first crowds and to give out coconuts as people came out. When we reached the cinema, there were indeed your actual crowds, people queuing right round the block. Once in the cinema, we were taken to a kind of broom cupboard below stairs where we felt like prisoners. There was coffee and doughnuts. We were told we couldn't go out of the theatre for fear of inciting riots on 3rd Avenue. "We've only got one patrolman," Don Rugoff, the American distributor, kept muttering morosely. I think he hoped that there would be riots, but we know our audience quite well. They want to be silly, they want to chat, but generally speaking, they don't want to tear us limb from limb. But they did fill the cinema all day long, and Rugoff was able to claim a house record take of $10,500. Robert Plant and Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin, who, along with Pink Floyd, had invested in the film, came to the 8 o'clock performance, which brightened things up a little. Suddenly someone shouted, "Led Zeppelin!" as we talked, and as the chant grew, we moved discreetly away, for they can cause riots. Tuesday, May the 13th, London. Eric's new show, Rutland Weekend Television, was on for the first time last night. Quite a milestone for Python, the first TV manifestation of the parting of the ways. Not a world-shattering show, but it was very much his particular kind of humour. I enjoyed it, and Terry Gilliam, who was watching with me, felt the same. Graham rang afterwards. He didn't like it, nor did Barry Cryer. I smell grapes. Stephen Frears, the director of Three Men in a Boat, came round to see me. We chatted for an hour or so. He didn't relax me a great deal. He's rather a disconcerting guy with unkempt hair and clothes and a rambling, discursive style of talking, which makes it very difficult for me to tell what he's actually saying. After I'd read it, I rang him back. He was pleased that I liked Tom Stoppard's script. I was 100% enthusiastic to be involved as any of the three characters, but Harris is really the part I want. He's the funniest, though I feel I'm physically wrong. Helen had made a superb steak and kidney pie with a Three Men in a Boat design on it. We ate it with half a bottle of Bollinger 64, a little prematurely, perhaps. Thursday, May the 22nd. My dates for Three Men in a Boat were confirmed today. They amount to nearly 6 weeks' work. The fee is a little more than half what I was offered to spend half an hour at the Nebworth concert. Say showbiz. Friday, June the 13th. In the afternoon, I had a tetanus jab at the BBC because of the suspicious nature of the Berkshire Thames. Then roared up the M4 in Stephen Frears' very shabby Cortina to Goring, where we found the 30-foot skiff, which we'll get to know rather well over the next 3 or 4 weeks. We fell uncannily easily into the roles. I rowed, because I like rowing and generally getting things done, being Harris. Tim Curry of Rocky Horror fame as Jay, in dark reflecting glasses, languidly took the rudder, while Stephen Moore as George just generally helped. Tuesday, September the 16th. Gilliam came round for a meal this evening to tell me about his Jabberwocky film, which he wants me to write with him. He has an overall plan for the film now, which I like the sound of very much. I'm undecided about whether to work on Jabberwocky. I like it because it sounds like a starter, and I like Terry Gilliam's sense of excitement about it, and I'm quickly infected by his enthusiasm. I'm also very confident that anything he puts his mind to will at least not be dull. But I want to see how successful Tompkinson's School Days will be, and how successful Three Men in a Boat will be, and I want to find some project of my own. I've tasted self-sufficiency, and a most agreeable taste it is. For all these reasons, I hang back. Friday, September the 19th. This evening is the first of John Cleese's solo efforts, Faulty Towers, which he's been working on with Connie Booth for over a year. Helen and I were reduced to tear-streaming laughter on one or two occasions. Basil Faulty rises to heights of manic extraordinariness. It has all the Cleese hallmark of careful, thoughtful, well-planned technical excellence. There was hardly a line in the piece or a moment when John wasn't going utterly spare. Whether he can keep it up, I don't know. It could become a bore. And certainly, there are as yet no reserves of warmth or sympathy in the character of Faulty to help it along.
And tomorrow, Michael Palin continues to read his diaries with a touching and poignant episode about his relationship with his ailing father. The abridger was Loris Morgan Griffiths and the producer, Louise Armitage.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. This is Susan Ray with a terrific drama for the hour starring Anna Chancellor. Elizabeth Bowen's wartime novel of Betrayal is adapted from a screenplay by Harold Pinter. It's both a love story and a thriller. Bowen's preoccupation with the psychology of hurt and betrayal is echoed in Pinter's work. And looking ahead, tonight, Watson's beating Sherlock Holmes at Cluedo in Concrete Cow, starring Robert Webb and Olivia Colman at 10:30. The tortuous nature of their affair is reflected in the doubts and uncertainties of Stella, the main character's relationship with her lover Robert. Stella discovers that Robert, who works for British intelligence, is suspected of selling classified information to the enemy. Harrison, the man who's tracked down Robert, wants Stella herself as the price for his silence. Caught between these two men, not sure whom to believe, Stella finds her world crumbling as she learns how little we can truly know of those around us.
The Heat of the Day, from a novel by Elizabeth Bowen, based on the screenplay by Harold Pinter. Episode 1. Interior. A room, London, 1942. 8 p.m. A man sitting at a table. One lamp is lit over the table. The man, Harrison, is sifting through photographs. The back of his head. His hands. The photographs.
Robert in officer's uniform with fellow officers emerging from a London club. Robert alone on a station platform. Robert alone at a bus stop. Robert and Stella in Regent's Park. Arm in arm.
Hand puts this photograph aside and continues sifting.
Robert in phone box. Robert and Stella hailing a taxi.
Hand puts this one aside.
Robert with two men at a street corner. Robert and Stella lying on the grass, asleep. She in a summer dress. He with open shirt. Stella lying on the grass. Eyes open.
Hand takes single photograph of Stella